One of the things that we looked at in the first addendum to Radio Free America 37 was the stern treatment meted out to Karl von Ossietzky, a Weimar Republic journalist who was reporting not only on secret German rearmament, but more importantly, on the illegal activities of the so-called Black Reichswehr, underground units of the German army originally formed to put down the German Revolution at the end of World War I. Those units then remained in place illegally and began a systematic program of assassination to eliminate all elements of progressive political activity in Germany. They did this, and that assassination program paved the way for Hitler's rise to power. I covered that assassination program in Radio Free America number 10 and in a miscellaneous archive show, which is available from archives on audio. In an addendum to Radio Free America 37, I pointed out that Karl von Ossietzky, originally jailed by the Weimar Republic, was interned in a concentration camp by the Nazis, only to be released in 1938. He died shortly after his release because of his mistreatment in that concentration camp, and he received the Nobel Peace Prize. His daughter, Rosalinda, has been appealing to the German authorities to rehabilitate Karl von Ossietzky's reputation, but the German courts have refused to hear the case. And again, Radio Free America number 37, one of the things that I pointed out, that among the elements of Nazism that were returned most completely to Germany in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, was the Third Reich's judicial system. Not only the many of the same laws, but many of the same judges that had held sway in Germany under Hitler were returned to power in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. And again, the harassment of journalists attempting to cover the neo-Nazi violence is disturbingly reminiscent of some of the things that went on in the quote, in pre-Hitler Germany. The next section of Martin Lee's article is called Coddling Kohl. Dubbed by author Günter Grass as a, quote, white-collar skinhead, unquote, Chancellor Kohl has repeatedly insisted to the press that asylum abuse, not racism, is the root of the problem. The German chancellor made no apology or public show of solidarity with the victims of neo-Nazi violence. This was reflected in a UPI headline of September 6, 1992 that read, quote, German leader issues lukewarm condemnation of neo-Nazi attacks, unquote. A news story in the British Independent of September 7th of 1992 warned that Kohl was, quote, rapidly creating a race relations disaster by using the violence to press his case for changing the liberal asylum provision in the Constitution, unquote. Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, 9-6-92, was one of the few U.S. reporters who explicitly acknowledged that Kohl's reaction to the neo-Nazi violence, quote, played into the hands of the extremists, unquote. For the most part, Kohl was handled with kid gloves by U.S. news media. CNN anchor David French, 10-3-92, depicted him as a man, quote, caught in the middle, trying to hold the nation together, unquote. A soundbite from Kohl followed. Extremists, quote, extremists from the right and the left have always brought disaster to our nation, unquote. Few media outlets challenge the equation of the Nazis with the left. When Bonn announced that tens of thousands of, quote, gypsies, unquote, would be deported to Romania where they had been persecuted, a New York Times editorial, September 27, 1992, titled, quote, Gypsies and Germans, comma, wronged, unquote, called the decision callous, quote, unquote, but quickly added that Germany also deserved sympathy for bearing most of Europe's immigration burden. Quote, Germany's critics have been unfair to accuse it of recidivist Nazi behavior, unquote, said the Times. I would add that perhaps Germany's critics have been unfair, and talking about recidivist Nazi behavior, that implies that somehow Nazism was returning to Germany. In fact, as I've indicated and as I documented extensively in Radio Free America 37, Nazism was never removed from Germany, so it would perhaps be inaccurate for it to, for us to talk about it returning, although certainly the sorts of overt, violent activities taking place in broad daylight are something which Germany has not seen much of. That does represent something of a throwback to the past. The next section of Martin Lee's article, the conclusion, is, in my opinion, the most important part because it indicates not only the extent to which the aims and desires of the current government in Germany are consistent with many of the same aims and desires as the so-called neo-Nazis, they are consistent with the aims and desires of the Third Reich, and beyond that, I think one can see in the next section a direct follow-up to many of the things that I discussed in Radio Free America number 37 namely the official support on behalf of the West German government for many of the so-called Landsmannschaft organizations, many of the Vertreibenden groups that were advocating the return of many of the Third Reich's territories in the east to Germany, and beyond that, the ultimate triumph of rollback or liberation theory, which began as a Third Reich political and psychological warfare technique. It evolved into a major American political and psychological warfare technique, and ultimately, as a result of the Crusade for Freedom, a domestic CIA operation which projected many elements related to the Galen spy organization into the leadership positions in American ethnic communities, the rollback or liberation theory ultimately evolved into a dominant element of 20th century American political thinking. In one of the last episodes of Radio Free America 37, I indicated the extent to which Befreiung or liberation represented a direct manifestation of the Third Reich's Ostpolitik in contemporary Germany, in the post-World War II Germany, and how the U.S. national security establishment, by adopting rollback or liberation theory, was in effect pursuing a political goal most clearly enunciated by Adolf Hitler, and which ultimately, that is to say, rollback or liberation theory, had its genesis with the Ostministerium of Alfred Rosenberg and the Third Reich. Note here that Martin Lee points out that both East German officials, or both German officials, excuse me, and German official German publications refer to the former East Germany as, quote, Middle Germany, unquote. Well, of course, if East Germany is, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, what would be thought to be, quote, East Germany, unquote? Clearly, the German officials and publications are referring to, what they are thinking about is that areas that had formerly been outside of Germany, but that had been under German control during World War II, areas of Czechoslovakia and Poland, for example, that no doubt constitutes East Germany in the minds of these officials, and that, of course, represents a direct realization or a complete realization of the goals of rollback or liberation theory. Again, ultimately, originally, I should say, a Third Reich psychological warfare and political warfare tactic. Ultimately, it became the successfully realized goal of American Cold War activity. And again, I refer people to Radio Free America shows 36 and 37, as well as RFA's 14 and 15 for some of the background. Actually, Radio Free America's 2, 14, 15, 36, and 37 for the relevant documentation in this regard. Returning to the Martin Lee article, the Times here, of course, is the New York Times, and after pointing out that Helmut Kohl's activities and those of the CDU, from a political standpoint, have been to essentially endorse the goals of the neo-Nazi violence, Helmut Kohl is working to expel foreigners, or at least to reduce German immigration and to return some foreigners, including gypsies regarded by the Third Reich as racial undesirables. They are now, the tide of immigration is going to be stemmed, apparently, by German legislation, and elements of the German government are moving in the direction of deporting gypsies, again, ominously reminiscent of what we saw during the Third Reich. Also note here again that German officials and German publications are referring to the former East Germany as Middle Germany. Martin Lee writes, "Perhaps the editors of the Times would be less complacent if the newspaper of record reported on top German officials who speak blithely of, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, when describing what until recently had been East Germany." The last sentence again, because it again relates directly to the line of argument presented in RFA 37. "Perhaps the editors of the Times would be less complacent if the newspaper of record reported on top German officials who speak blithely of, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, when describing what until recently had been East Germany. Listed in the official German budget, which also refers to, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, are government funds earmarked for, quote, Vertreibenden groups." Reading the last sentence again. "Listed in the official German budget, which also refers to, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, are government funds earmarked for, quote, Vertreibenden, unquote, groups that seek to repatriate Germany's so-called eastern territories, including the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, Silesia, Pomerania, Prussia, and other German enclaves." Christian Science Monitor 10192. And again, the last sentence. And this also with the support by the German governments for the Vertreibenden groups, in particular the so-called Expelle ministry, headed up for a time by former SS officer, anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and world anti-communist leader Theodor Oberländer, an individual we discussed prominently in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15 and 37. The Vertreibenden groups are still receiving receiving funding from the German government. This is not a new phenomenon by any reason, by any means, I should say. And again, I refer people to the aforementioned archive shows for documentation and discussion of this. Reading again this last sentence from Martin Lee's article, listed in the official German budget, which also refers to, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, are government funds earmarked for, quote, Vertreibenden, unquote, groups that seek to repatriate Germany's so-called eastern territories, including Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, Silesia, Pomerania, Prussia, and other alleged German enclaves. Christian Science Monitor 10/1/92. Recall that prior to the Rostock pogrom, a Rostock city official reported to the German Interior Ministry that, in fact, neo-Nazi violence was being planned for that city. The German government did not respond. We're going to take a look at Deputy Interior Minister Eduard Lindner, L-I-N-T-N-E-R, a key member of Kohl's CDU party, and some of his political affiliations would perhaps render less than shocking the complacent response of the Interior Ministry of Germany to the warning by the Rostock official. Martin Lee writes, Deputy Interior Minister Eduard Lindner, a key member of Kohl's CDU party, is himself a figure within the Sudeten German Landsmannschaft, a right-wing extremist group founded by SS officers at the end of World War II. That sentence again. Deputy Interior Minister Eduard Lindner, a member of Kohl's CDU party, is himself a key figure within the Sudeten German Landsmannschaft, that's L-A-N-D-S-M-A-N-N-S-C-H-A-F-T, a right-wing extremist group founded by SS officers at the end of World War II. Lindner's organization advocates German expansion into neighboring Czechoslovakia. Fritz Neubauer, N-E-U-B-A-U-E-R, a leading figure in the Christian Social Union, Bavaria's CDU faction, recently proclaimed that all treaties with Czechoslovakia should be considered invalid when that country breaks into two parts. If that's not Nazi recidivism, what is? Marty Lee asks. Note, too, that the independence of Slovakia, now there is no more Czechoslovakia, Slovakia has broken off from the former Czechoslovakia. That, too, represents a realization of rollback or liberation theory. Slovakia was an independent state under the Nazi rule in Eastern Europe. The Nazi collaborationist Reverend Josef Tiso set up the independent state of Slovakia, and the fascist party of that state, the Linka Party, spelled H-L-I-N-K-A, also, like so many of the Eastern European fascist political parties, became a key component not only of the Galen organization vis-a-vis Czechoslovakia, but also became a key element of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, an organization founded by Adolf Hitler in 1943 that went on to become a key element of the World Anti-Communist League, an ultra-right-wing organization which has become a dominant influence on American foreign and covert action policy in the post-World War II period. That organization saw its power increase enormously, not only through the assassination of John Kennedy, but later on, and particularly during the Reagan and Bush administrations. So again, note that Deputy Interior Minister Eduard Lindner is a key member of the Sudeten-Deutsche Landsmannschaft, an organization founded by SS officers at the end of World War II, and like so many of the Vertreibenden groups, it was actually funded by the German government. Note also that the German government is referring to, quote, Middle Germany, when referring to the former East Germany as, quote, Middle Germany, unquote, while funding groups that advocate the return of Germany's, quote, former, unquote, the return of Germany's former, quote, territories, unquote, such as large sections of Czechoslovakia and Poland. And note again, Franz Neubauer, a leading figure in the Christian Social Union, recently proclaiming that all treaties between Germany and Czechoslovakia are now null and void. And indeed, as Martin Lee says here, if that's not Nazi recidivism, what is? Well, I don't know. Again, I would cite one of my favorite phrases, and that comes from author William Faulkner, who said, "The past is never dead and buried. it isn't even passed. And note, too, that the sparse, and I'm being charitable, the sparse journalistic coverage given to the return of the resurgence of Nazism in Germany is only too typical of the way fascism has been handled in the past. One of the major points that I made in Radio Free America number 37 is that one of the things both the German general staff and the Nazi party in particular learned early on in the immediate post-World War I period was that anti-communism could be used as an excellent vehicle for conquest. And indeed, the resurgence or the return of Nazism to Germany came about in considerable measure because of the extreme anti-communism of the Third Reich. And during the Cold War period, the return of Nazism to Germany by the Allies was downplayed or even completely ignored in the Western press because it became necessary to portray West Germany as democratic while East Germany was Stalinist totalitarian. And likewise, after the end of the Cold War, it is necessary to represent the triumph of West Germany over East Germany as the triumph of democracy over totalitarianism. And we are not seeing the coverage of the return of Nazi violence to Germany. We're not seeing that being covered in the way it should be. On the contrary, not only is that violence being downplayed, but the more significant connections and degrees of intersection and the degrees of coincident viewpoint between the so-called neo-Nazis and the German government, the German government per se, those are being ignored by the Western media and by the American media. That also is disturbingly reminiscent of the way the American media covered the rise of fascism the first time around. As we have looked at in so many programs, and what is one of the pillars of these broadcasts for these many years, fascism is not an aberration. In this country, fascism is portrayed as an aberration, as the work of lone nut, so to speak. A lone nut Hitler hypnotized all the Germans, made them all go crazy, along came the Allies, and made everything right. The same is true in the viewpoint of the American media and American history of Mussolini's Italy as well. In fact, fascism was anything but an aberration. It represented a considered, organized response by many of the world's top industrialists and financiers, and they allied general staffs of those countries to the rise not only of the world's first socialist country, the Soviet Union, but the threat or perceived threat of the rise of socialism or Marxism in other countries as well. This, again, is in no way to... This should be in no way interpreted as an endorsement of the former Soviet Union's system of government, but the rise of fascism, the very event of fascism, was in no way an accident. It was in no way an aberration. On the contrary, as one studies the real history of fascism, one inevitably, if one pursues the investigation properly, one inevitably comes across the central fact of fascism, which is that it was avidly supported by the most powerful industrial and financial interests in the so-called Western democracies. You look for the names behind fascism, and in this country you come across the names of major corporations such as Standard Oil of New Jersey, General Motors, the Ford Motor Company, IT&T, and so forth. Fascism was not an aberration. Because of that, it is something that is at least as much of a threat now as it was before, although some of the tactics of fascism have become more subtle, as we can see now in Germany. Many of the tactics being pursued are precisely the same tactics that were pursued before, and precisely because fascism, far from being an aberration, was the direct outgrowth of considered and long-term action by many of the most powerful industrial and financial interests in the world, it is something that has to be studied, and it is something that has to be resisted both actively and in a broad-based manner, because otherwise it is going to come back. It is, in fact, coming back, and without a serious recognition on the part of a large number of people that, in fact, fascism was what it was, a direct and conscious policy of many of the most powerful interests in the world, interests which are now preeminent in the world, even in areas they had not been before. I am afraid that fascism is going to recognize its ultimate, or will realize, I should say, its ultimate triumph. It is, in my opinion, doing that in the United States today. It has apparently done that in much of Europe, and I'm afraid this represents a trend for the future. Again, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And in this past article, in this addendum to Radio Free America 37, we have been looking at the return of fascism in Germany and the lack of coverage of many of those fascist activities and elements by the American press. What we're going to begin looking at in the next section of One Step Beyond is one of the manifestations of fascism in the United States. And specifically, we are going to be this evening beginning an archive show, which will go into the archives as Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection Part 3, Realizing the Fourth Reich. We're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to continue with the next portion of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. The next portion of the prepared portion of tonight's program is going to go into the archives as the seventh in an ongoing Radio Free America series dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. This program is going to be called The Terror Connection, actually The Terror Connection Part 4, and it is Radio Free America number 38, Realizing the Fourth Reich. It is going to be, this archive show is going to be downloaded over the period of the next 3 or 4 weeks, and it's going to touch on a number of activities seemingly unrelated, but which in fact have certain common historical and strategic threads. Perhaps an interesting jumping-off point would be, and this is not going to relate directly to the Iran-Contra scandal, but involve some of the same things that were involved in aspects of it, I'm going to relate an article which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, an article which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, January 14th of 1993. This is a Los Angeles Times story, Dateline Washington headlined, Panel says U.S. secretly aided Laotian rebels. This particular article directly confirms some information that was in a series that I did on the POW-MIA question, and specifically I accessed some information from the Napa Sentinel and Harry Martin that described, among other things, the cover-up of the POW-MIA question vis-a-vis the Vietnam War. That cover-up occurred in part, at least, because the ostensible search for POWs and MIAs was used as a front for covert action in Southeast Asia. Also, information from a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson and William Stevenson goes into that to a certain extent. And in the recent report by the Senate Select Committee on POWs and MIAs, there was confirmation that, in fact, the ostensible search for POWs and MIAs was used by elements of the intelligence community to stage covert actions in Southeast Asia. This article reads in part, President Ronald Reagan's White House ran a covert operation using POW-MIA activist groups as fronts to funnel aid to anti-communist Laotian rebels in the mid-1980s, according to documents and Senate investigators. The Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA Affairs has unanimously agreed to ask the Justice Department to open a criminal investigation into the matter. Quote, what we basically want the Justice Department to do is to tell us if what we are dealing with here is, quote, the son of Ollie North, unquote, said Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, a member of the committee. Grassley is G-R-A-S-S-L-E-Y. The operation, presumably intended to destabilize the communist government of Laos, was financed in part by private donors, who later formed the nucleus of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's secret Iran-Contra fundraising network. Last sentence again. The operation, presumably intended to destabilize the communist government of Laos, was financed in part by private donors who later formed the nucleus of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's secret Iran-Contra fundraising network. Donors were told that their contributions were for a White House-backed effort to search for servicemen listed as missing in Laos. The funds were funneled through a POW-MIA group in Southern California and overseas channels, including the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, according to records obtained by the investigators. It's interesting to see that among the funding conduits for this covert operation, according to the sources cited here, was the BCCI. That particular institution has been utilized by the U.S. intelligence community for a wide variety of activities, including providing financial support for covert operations involving drug dealing and supporting terrorism. Among the Iran-Contra players who used that institution for some of their activities include Manzur El-Kassar, an individual we will talk more about later, a fellow, Adnan Khashoggi, Oliver North, and a fellow named Arif Durrani, about whom we will have a little more to say later. They were among the Iran-Contra players who utilized BCCI for some of the operations connected with the Iran-Contra scandal. And again, among the reasons why the POW/MIA question had to be covered up, and even the Senate Select Committee did not go into the matter to the extent that they might have, is that a true investigation of that question would come across various illegalities vis-a-vis covert operations for a long period of time, going all the way back to the Vietnam War itself, when some of the covert operations conducted in our Southeast Asian crusade involved support for narcotics trafficking, all the way on up to the present, when the ostensible search for POWs and MIAs was in fact used as a cover for ongoing covert action in that part of the world. It's also worth noting that some of the donors apparently utilized by the Reagan and Bush administrations for this covert operation in Southeast Asia also figured prominently in the Contra support effort as well. For the benefit of those who hear this program on tape, today is January 17th, 1993. In a few days, Bill Clinton becomes President of the United States and George Bush will leave after 12 straight years of Republican control of the White House. And it's worth noting that as George Bush is leaving office, he has to a large extent upstaged Bill Clinton. The incoming administration has, from a journalistic standpoint, had to take a back seat to a considerable extent to Bush administration military operations in both Somalia and the Persian Gulf. As we speak now, more air raids have been conducted in recent days against Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And, of course, the U.S. military is involved in a big, big way in the peacekeeping mission in Somalia. Later on in Radio Free America number 38, we're going to talk about some of the elements, some of the common elements between some of the things that went on in the Iran-Contra scandal and what I suspect is one of the major strategic goals of the situation in Somalia. But suffice it to say for our purposes right now, note that the U.S., even as Bush prepares to leave office, is engaged in two major military operations in the Persian Gulf Horn of Africa area, in the Persian Gulf area. And note also that among the things that have been upstaged by these military operations concern George Bush's recent pardon of a number of offenders in the Iran-Contra scandal and the former CIA people, Caspar Weinberger and others. Had there been a proper investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal, no one would have been tarred more thoroughly than George Bush. Far from being out of the loop, as he maintained for a period of time, George Bush was not only very much aware of the illegalities in the arms transfers to Iran. A recent interview with George Bush, the transcript of that was recently released to the press, confirming what most intelligent people have known, namely that George Bush was quite aware of what was going on vis-a-vis the Iran-Contra scandal. A serious student of the national security establishment would no doubt find out that George Bush not only knew about what was going on, there is no individual more central to the events in and around the Iran-Contra scandal than George Bush. The Iran-Contra scandal per se, far from being an isolated historical occurrence, was the most visible portion of a national security iceberg which stretched out for a long period of time, which involved a wide variety of activities beyond the immediate scope of those subsumed under the title Iran-Contra scandal, and the implications for those national security elements and events which brought us the national security scandal, the long-term, or brought us the Iran-Contra scandal, the long-term implications are very grave indeed. And those implications ultimately threaten most directly even those elements of democratic rule remaining in the United States. It's worth noting that the Reagan and Bush administrations, and in my opinion, they can be viewed as one long administration. George Bush simply perpetuated the policies that Ronald Reagan undertook. This administration came to power as the result of a covert operation, namely the October Surprise, about which we're going to have something to say in a minute. It's worth noting that this past week as well, a congressional report poo-pooing the notion that a deal was in fact cut between the Reagan and Bush campaigns and the Khomeini forces in Iran. This is yet another in a long series of official denials of things which can be readily verified from an impartial examination of the history that is on the public record. Not only did the October Surprise take place, it is in fact inextricably linked with a number of other national security scandals, including the Iran-Contra scandal proper. There are substantive indications that the weapons transfers, which eventually came to light in late 1986, had been going on since 1981 and were in all probability connected directly to the dilly-dallying between the Reagan and Bush administrations, and between the Reagan-Bush campaign, I should say, and the Khomeini forces in Iran. It is worth noting, too, that as this 12-year administration leaves power, its activities continue to be the focus of cover-up activities as well as investigations. A reference to that in the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle from today, January 17th, 1993. I'm not going to read this article, but it's worth noting that among the issues which hang in the balance concerning the erasing of computer tapes, which would preserve a lot of the information that related to not only the Iran-Contra scandal, but other activities of the Reagan and Bush administrations, many of them apparently illegal. This particular article is headlined, "Grave Loss Feared If Bush Officials Wipe Out Tapes," subheaded, "Computers Stored Notes and Memos from Iran-Contra to Desert Storm." It's authored by Tim Bovee, B-O-V-E-E, of the Associated Press. It's datelined Washington. I'm not going to read the whole article, but I will read a short section of it. Suffice it to say, skipping down in the article, quote, "If the information remains available on tape, then computers can be used to search for it. For example, during the investigation on former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega, the Justice Department used computers to search files from the Reagan era." Well, if files, computer files from the Reagan era were truly investigated vis-a-vis Manuel Noriega and a great many other things, the disclosures would prove fundamentally damaging to not only the national security establishment, but to those forces allied with the Reagan and Bush administrations. Among the voices that continue to be ignored to a large extent, and these voices come to a certain extent at least from people who were directly involved at the operation level in some of the activities related to the Iran-Contra scandal, among the most ignored of voices is a former Israeli intelligencer named Ari Ben-Menashe. Ben-Menashe was a highly placed Israeli intelligence official involved in a number of activities involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. Some of the things Ben-Menashe has had to say in the past did not pan out entirely, but many of the things he has had to say in the past panned out only too well. Ben-Menashe has a new book out which contains a number of very important allegations, many of them corroborated by information from other sources. The book is being largely ignored, but it should not be. It contains some very important information, and vis-a-vis, for example, George Bush and the aforementioned Manuel Noriega, drug trafficker extraordinaire and longtime associate of U.S. intelligence and George Bush, Ari Ben-Menashe has some interesting things to say in this book. The book is entitled Prophets of War, subtitled Inside the Secret U.S.-Israeli Arms Network. Again, it's authored by Ari Ben-Menashe, first name A-R-I, last name capital B-E-N hyphen, capital M-E-N-A-S-H-E. This book was published in hardcover. In dealing with the Carl Evans book, I crossed publishers with this particular book. The Evans book is published by Thunder's Mouth Press and copyrighted 1993. Prophets of War is Sheridan Square Press, so I have confused the two books. The Carl Evans book about the assassination of Malcolm X that I dealt with earlier was published in hardcover by Thunder's Mouth Press, copyright 93. The Prophets of War by Ari Ben-Menashe is copyrighted 1993, but it was published by the Sheridan Square Press. And in this particular passage of The Prophets of War, Ben-Menashe describes one of the many areas of cooperation between U.S. and Israeli intelligence during the Reagan and Bush eras. One of the major aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal was the cooperative activity both in Central America and the Middle East by U.S. and Israeli intelligence. They worked together in the apparent October surprise. They worked together in the arming and training of various security forces in Latin America, as well as supporting the Contras, and they worked together to transfer arms to Iran. Among the activities that involved the cooperation between elements of U.S. and elements of Israeli intelligence involves a weapons trafficking network originally founded by associates of former Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, and which ultimately came to be utilized by the CIA, as well as Israeli intelligence, to traffic, among other things, cocaine up from Central America in order to finance arms going down to Central America. The related cocaine and weapons trade became a major focus of the investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal. It was one of the aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal which never emerged into the official version to the extent that it should have, and it's one of the many things, one of the many skeletons in the closet of the Reagan and Bush administrations, which awaits a full disclosure or at least full recognition by the public. It should be noted that at the center of this Israeli-U.S. intelligence network, again originally founded by associates of Ariel Sharon for trafficking weapons to Central America and ultimately utilized by U.S. intelligence to help set up a slush fund of cocaine money, which was utilized to finance arms purchases and covert operations in Central America, the Contra support effort in particular, and central to this U.S.-Israeli intelligence relationship vis-a-vis drug trafficking and the Iran-Contra scandal was the relationship between the aforementioned Manuel Noriega and the aforementioned George Bush. Ari Ben-Menashe writes as follows in The Prophets of War. Sharon's network, that's the aforementioned arms trafficking network, originally founded by Ariel Sharon and associates and ultimately co-opted to a certain extent by U.S. intelligence, beginning again, Sharon's network had been able to provide military equipment from Israel to various Central American countries, including El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, Costa Rica, and even Mexico. This was never official Israeli government policy, and it was frowned upon by the cabinet itself, but Sharon was too wild a goose for anybody to handle. So Sharon's private network bought their weapons from Israeli government factories and got their export licenses from the Israeli government. Gates had developed a professional interest in the arms network that Sharon and his former intelligence cowboys were operating in Central America. By 1981, Sharon and Harari were running what Harari described as more of a CIA network than an Israeli operation, and were filling their private bank accounts at the same time. It was in 1981 that they started supplying a secret army in Central America, the Contras, who were trying to destabilize and eventually bring about the downfall of the Sandinista government of Nicaragua, which had come to power in 1979. The Contras did not have any money. Congress was not then willing to fund them, and desperately needed cash to buy their arms. Sharon, with all his power, could not force the Prime Minister or the leaders of the Israeli intelligence community to pay for weapons from the slush fund that had grown out of the Iran arms sales. So, with the backing of Gates and the CIA, some members of the group created their own fund. They did this, according to Harari, by transporting cocaine from South America to the United States via Central America. A major player was Manuel Noriega, who had known George Bush since he had been the CIA chief in the mid-1970s. Hundreds of tons of cocaine poured into the United States, and another handy slush fund was created. Recall, we've seen indications concerning Noriega, the Central American cocaine trade, its relationship to the Contra support effort, from numerous sources, including several official investigations by the Costa Rican government. Of course, the unsuccessful Christic Institute investigation turned up information from a number of sources corroborating this. I would note also that a couple of Harry Martin's investigations from the Napa Sentinel, including the drug tug case and his work on the POW-MIA question, in which some of his contacts in the intelligence community released the details of Operation Maya. That operation was the CIA's cocaine importing operation used to finance the Contras. And again, some of Harry Martin's contacts in the intelligence community provided him with hard documentation on that, which remains as a sort of a deterrent to hands-on interference with Harry Martin. But George Bush was, of course, not only at the center of many of the activities that were involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, as we will see in weeks to come. George Bush was also head of the South Florida Task Force, ostensibly in charge with preventing the influx of narcotics into the United States. It certainly did not do that, and given the relationship between George Bush and Oliver North and many of the activities going to support the Contra War, George Bush's past involvement with the CIA and Noriega, the extent of George Bush's personal responsibility, as well as the executive responsibility of the Reagan and Bush administrations for the activities that have been described here by Ari Ben-Menashe and corroborated by numerous other sources, these are among the cocaine traffic and the official winking at it, if not actual participation in it, by elements of our intelligence community. Those are among the skeletons in the closet of the Reagan and Bush administrations, which will in all probability remain closed. It's worth noting that not only complicity on the part of the Reagan and Bush administrations with the narcotics traffic, but also complicity with those same administrations And the international terrorist community are among the things which lie at the bottom of the Iran-Contra scandal and things which have not received the recognition due them in the popular press. Following story was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, December 26th of 1992. It's a Robert Pear story from the New York Times, datelined Washington, and it's headlined, Congress Likely to Probe Pardons. This, of course, refers to the pardons by George Bush of, among others, Caspar Weinberger, some CIA officials involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. And these pardons have avoided the possibility that George Bush himself, at least for the time being, that George Bush himself might become at least a witness to testify in court, if not an actual focus of the investigations themselves. This article reads in part, Congress will probably investigate the pardons granted by President Bush to former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and five other men involved in the Arms for Hostages scandal, congressional aides said Friday. Democratic congressional leaders, including House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt and Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, condemned the Christmas Eve pardons. Gephardt said the pardons suggested, quote, presidential approval of violations of the law, unquote. Mitchell said Bush's action implied that lying to Congress was not a serious offense. But Senator Robert Dole of Kansas, the Republican minority leader, called the pardon of Weinberger an act of courage and compassion. Quote, it's clear that Lawrence Walsh and his desperate henchmen would have stopped at nothing to validate their reckless $35 million inquisition, even if it meant twisting justice to fit their partisan schemes, Dole said. Representative Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, chairman of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Criminal Justice, said he understood the holiday spirit that had prompted Bush to grant pardons to Weinberger and the others. But Schumer expressed concern that, quote, a high proportion of the pardons went to the president's political allies, unquote, and he said the pardons suggested a presidential feeling of contempt for Congress. Well, in fact, at the core of the Iran-Contra scandal was a national security infrastructure that grew directly out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism. We're going to look at that next week and how the governmental infrastructure set up to deal with, quote, counterterrorism, unquote, and to combat terrorism was, in fact, utilized for a number of activities, including promoting the very terrorism it was supposed to combat, and beyond that, even more importantly, how the infrastructure set up as a result of national security decisions growing out of the Vice President, at that time George Bush's task force, on counterterrorism, that infrastructure was ultimately used to completely bypass and to subvert the legitimate constitutional authority. And on January 17th, 1993, as the Bush administration prepares to depart from Washington, and as the Clinton administration prepares to come in, it's worth noting that this infrastructure remains in place, that just as Jimmy Carter inherited a national security establishment that was largely hostile to him and which appears to have destabilized his administration, Bill Clinton also comes into a Washington, D.C., which at its foundations is controlled by the same forces that he campaigned against, unless the powers that be in this country, meaning basically the political powers that be, and you and I take this into account and correct it, it is unlikely that any kind of serious reform will grow out of the Clinton administration vis-a-vis the national security establishment. Just a minute ago, we touched on the firm evidence from a number of different sources that, in fact, among the illegal activities subsumed under the Iran-Contra scandal was complicity on the part of the Contra support network in the cocaine trade. Again, Radio Free America shows 29 through 33 deal with that. The Miscellaneous Archive show dealing with the drug tug case, in addition to some of the information that was available out of the Christic suit. The Kerry subcommittee report confirms much of that information, and official investigations by the Costa Rican government turned up information which corroborates many of these other sources. Ari Ben Menashe's voice added to a growing body of information supporting those allegations.